This is Don Goddard back in the NBC newsroom in New York. And New York, the nation's metropolis, the news of the invasion was greeted here with calmness, too, with a spirit of prayer and with a full awareness of the meaning of this momentous occasion in history. Typical, perhaps, was the reaction of some 500 men and women at work in war production at their benches at the Bendix Aviation Corporation's plant over in Brooklyn. There, in the dark hours of this morning, they heard that news with a lusty cheer, and then they returned to their task to turn out more implements of war to carry on the great offensive. And the New York stock market reflected the confidence of American business in these parts. The market was quiet, and U.S. Treasury bonds held steady as a rock. And New York's racetracks were closed today, along with others throughout the country. In the Times Square district, where soldiers and sailors on furlough were still entertaining themselves and their girlfriends, there the servicemen stood in front of loudspeakers, hearing the news over the radio. And one sailor said, "I wish I'd been there myself." Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the story of how the news of the invasion came to the United States of America, the reaction on the home front from stations in Cleveland, Chicago, Denver, Hollywood, San Francisco, and here from Don Goddard in the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Some of the dangers and the difficulties which appeared at this time last night extremely formidable are already behind us. Passage of the sea was made with far less loss than was anticipated. The resistance of coastal batteries was greatly weakened by our bombing. In fact, it was weakened more than we had expected. And then the superior bombardment of our warships, which lent such valiant aid to our invading forces, quickly reduced the power of these batteries to such small dimensions that they did not affect our landing problem. The Allied landing forces have already penetrated several miles inland from several points on the French coast. Our airborne troops have captured several strategic bridges intact and are holding them pending the arrival of our mechanized forces. Fighting is proceeding for the possession of the city of Caen, one of the most important of Normandy, its chief rail center. The Allied invasion forces everywhere met less resistance than expected. And this is true in the approaches to the beachheads as well as in the air. The Germans told us in a bulletin just a few minutes ago that our invasion beachheads have been further widened. And an observer at Allied headquarters summed up the situation in these words: "We have gotten over the first 5 or 6 hurdles." Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force tells us that the Allied landings in France were postponed 24 hours due to bad weather. They were originally scheduled for yesterday morning, which might suggest that they were intended to be timed with the capture of Rome, for that would have started the invasion within 24 hours of the capture by Allied forces of the Eternal City. Our bombing effort reached a new climax yesterday and today. Some 2,300 United States and British bombers dropped 11,200 tons of bombs in 8.5 hours. They were dropped on gun emplacements guarding the invasion coast. You must look to that air bombardment for a part of the explanation of our unexpectedly rapid progress in these first invasion stages. Despite this effort, the Allied air forces maintained effective air cover for our troops and for our naval forces. Remember, we have 11,000 first-line planes in Britain, and every one of them is swinging into action today. The first German fighter plane opposition to the invasion forces was reported this afternoon. There were many dogfights. It came at the very moment when Marshal Goering told his Luftwaffe, "This invasion must be fought off, even if it means the death of the Luftwaffe." That's not an optimistic statement to present to a defensive fighter force at this stage of the invasion. The British Prime Minister also announced this afternoon that the Allies had captured a number of important bridges, and he also said that the airborne landings were on a scale far larger than anything seen so far in the world. The Germans told us that we had landed 4 divisions of airborne troops. Yank, the paper published, no, Stars and Stripes, not Yank, the paper published in Naples tells us that we landed 30,000 paratroopers. Well, that would be the better part of the fighting force of 4 divisions. That, of course, is by far the largest number of troops ever landed from the air. The great invasion of Crete, which was a classic in paratroop landings, included only 1 division. And so here, our initial effort, 4 times as great and more to come. Admiral Ingersoll revealed in Washington that United States battleships, cruisers, and destroyers are participating in the invasion. It is their bombardment, theirs and that of the British warships, that has helped to silence many of these coastal batteries on which the Germans relied to hold off the invasion ships. The Germans claim that 1 cruiser was sunk, which is a mighty small claim when you consider the tremendous naval force that is involved in this action. Some may ask, why France instead of Belgium or Holland or Norway or Denmark? France is the beginning. France is nearest. France has been softened up. France has a strong underground. These are reasons enough for us to make our beginning in France. It's curious that in this invasion, some of the best news comes to us from the Nazis. The Paris radio said tonight, a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. These paratroops, the Paris radio says, landed behind the Atlantic Wall defenses. That is the encouraging thing, that our invasion technique has sufficed to put us behind that great Atlantic defense wall on which Hitler relied. This battle in Rouen is something that we have had no word of from Allied sources, but it's quite possible, for remember that we have landed in the estuary of the Seine. That was announced early today, and Rouen is somewhat farther inland, 100 miles down the Seine, and is, of course, a tremendously important point. No, not 100 miles. Rouen must be something like 40 miles down the Seine from the harbor where we landed early this morning. 31,000 Allied airmen were over France from midnight to 8 a.m., and that does not count parachute and glider troops. The conference of the High Command in Washington with President Roosevelt has ended. Admiral King, commander of the United States fleet, said after the conference with the president that the invasion of Europe is doing all right so far. And Admiral King is a conservative commentator. And so, as you look at the picture, you see everywhere initial Allied success. You see the result of the careful preparation of these past 2-3 years. You see the result of our experience in Sicily, in Africa, in Italy. We have learned, and what we have learned, we are putting into practice today. We have accumulated the necessary force. We have developed the necessary technique. Yes, there may be setbacks. There may be delays. But the story of these first hours of invasion tells us what we know in our hearts, that we are sure of victory and that it may come sooner than many of us had supposed. Good afternoon.
The National Broadcasting Company now presents Lieutenant Colonel James Stevenson, United States Army retired, a military analyst, who looks upon our invasion operation from a background of personal experiences.
For before his retirement, he was a member of the staff of that command which helped train our troops for the amphibious operations which they've undertaken today across the Channel, the direct assault on France. We present Colonel Stevenson.
Well, now that the invasion has actually started, and action seems to be moving rapidly, it is rather difficult to make out exactly where the spearhead is striking. But that is unimportant. The latest reports indicate that the landing at Le Havre was a major stroke. Our troops are moving in quickly and fanning out. It appears that we have made a serious threat to the German right flank in the defense of the long French Atlantic coastline. As this action proceeds, I believe you will see more landings along this coastline. For here are the huge harbors and docking facilities that we must have to maintain a great force of men in Europe. Great West Coast ports with docking and railroad facilities that we need to supply a great army. We used those facilities in the last war, and we need them again. Without them, we are pinched for room to operate. With them, we have breathing space and a chance to organize our great land forces for the push toward the east. As the great beachhead at Le Havre develops, and we push further inland, we offer more and more a threat to the Nazi defenses along the coastline. There will be only one way for the Germans to save themselves, and that will be to draw back. Otherwise, they will take the chance of being pocketed along that west coast. And as they draw back toward their inner defenses, they will find the roads difficult because they do not run parallel to each other, as in Germany. Oh, no, the French roads radiate from central points, which is natural to France's terrain. The country is laid out as in layers, something like saucers, one on top of the other, the bigger saucers on the bottom. And each rim is a natural obstacle to get over. And it is because of the natural terrain that the Allied command must have those West Coast ports. Now, there's been some speculation that there might be an invasion from the south, from the Mediterranean. I do not believe it is necessary, for as our forces drive down from Normandy, where they landed today, and as they move into the West Coast ports, the Nazis will be compelled to pull out of the south to save themselves. Their only other alternative is to be trapped against the Alps Mountains in the east, where the few roads will not be sufficient to allow escape. So in all probability, the action within the next few days will develop south from Le Havre, in fast bold strokes, with new landings to be made on the Atlantic or Bay of Biscay coast. There is the possibility that we will try to move down to Paris, about 110 miles away, as quickly as possible, for its psychological effect, just as we drove up the long, rocky Italian coast to take Rome. The prestige and the happy effect it would have upon all the shackled people of Europe would be invaluable, because we must remember that part of our strategy is to get these people actively working for and supporting our forces. But the important thing now is getting those West Coast ports, squeezing the Nazis out of that part of France. And the action seems to indicate that that is exactly what we're doing. We must remember that armies need tremendous amounts of supplies, and that everything which is being done now is based on that fact. We must get the docks. We must get the harbors. And our forces are driving down from Le Havre to ensure that we do get them. The Nazi-operated Paris radio, quoting a last-minute flash from the battlefield, says that a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. The Paris radio says these paratroops landed behind the Atlantic wall defenses. And further indicating tougher going, here's a bulletin which says, a bulletin from London, Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, in an order of the day, told Nazi airmen that the invasion must be fought off, even if it means the death of the Luftwaffe. Earlier, though, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, in his second report to Commons today on the Allied invasion of Western Europe, said that on the basis of the latest information from the front, and I'm quoting him now, I can state to the House that this operation is proceeding in a thoroughly satisfactory manner. And even the German DNB agency said at 6:30 p.m. London time that the invasion has further widened. According to the German version this morning, then, several landings were made both east and west of Laha. They are expecting more landings to the west, and well they may. The action will develop to the south and west until the Germans are driven east toward Paris and the Belgian frontier from which they came.
Thank you, Colonel Stevenson. The National Broadcasting Company has just brought you a military analysis of our invasion operations by Lieutenant Colonel Stevenson, USA retired, an expert on amphibious operations.
On this historic D-Day, the day of invasion, the news comes thick and fast in the early hours of this morning, at a time when most of the nation slept. It was then, for instance, that we got the exciting report from Merrill Muller, NBC's correspondent at General Eisenhower's headquarters, of how the correspondents themselves were brought up to date on the operation. And for the benefit of those who did not hear that broadcast, NBC now presents a transcription of the historic report.
If I never attend another press conference in my life, I shall certainly remember this one. Perhaps because its outstanding factor was that it was more like a staff conference than a general talk to newspaper men. Here's the picture. Remember that all around us, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men were readying themselves for the outbreak of the battle that all the world had waited for four long, dark years. Men from the far corners of the world, ready to erase the stain of Dunkirk, to lift the shrouds of Nazi tyranny, to crush the Axis in the growth of the United Nations. Aeroplanes growled overhead. Ships were gathering and steaming off into the channel, and final road convoys rumbled into the embarkation areas. We all sprawled around the general's private field office and were given the picture. In a tiny tent, some 15 feet square, we sat and listened to the most amazing delivery of dynamic facts I have ever heard. We overcrowded and spilled half out of the tent onto its backyard concrete terrace. It is a modest office. The inner wall of the tent is half-lined from the ground up with slats from packing cases. And some ingenious sergeant has stained those slats into imitation fine paneling. The floor is concrete with a couple of rope rugs. There's one desk, a telephone, two chairs, and a moderate wall mat. Otherwise, the tent show is a tree-shaded terrace and three pieces of deck chair furniture. You have to tear your eyes from the general to note these things because he holds your interest completely. When you appreciate his tremendous command of facts and figures, duplicated, I think, only by General Marshall, you understand why he was picked for this assignment. It is not opportune to release the details of our briefing on behalf of the general, except in three general ways. One, he wanted all the credit for this campaign to go to the common soldiers of the Allied armies, and he emphasized the lower ranks and the word Allied. His order of the day takes that vein. Two, he had nothing but praise for the untiring efforts and inexhaustible research of his various staffs and his various commanders for air, sea, armies, and supplies. Three, as to the actual plan itself, perhaps I can best put it this way. I have been in on all of General Eisenhower's amphibious assaults, but none was as involved or as mammoth as this one. Last-minute headaches? Yes, the general had a last-minute headache. And he expressed it beautifully when he suddenly jumped from his chair and said, "Good heavens, there's some sunshine." Otherwise, the invasion of Europe had already been pat for days. We came out of the tent and strolled toward his proudest, newest possession, just the general and myself. He praised his new mobile office, a super deluxe job built into a 10-ton truck and trailer and presented to him by the Lockheed workers here. And then I asked him about his own nerves. He stopped, hatless in the sun. He is supposed to be phlegmatic. But he said quietly, "I'm so gall darn nervous, I boil over." He's not supposed to show it. He didn't either. I caught him only twice, wringing his hands or jiggling his English change. But I like reporting that he is human enough to feel what the lowliest of his troops feel. We went to a parachuter space just before their takeoff for France. For this invasion, the general honors his vast airborne forces that are now employed in battle. We went from airfield to airfield, talking to the airborne troops and to the Air Force crews that flew them to their targets. The general's car would roll up, and always the procedure was the same. The men would snap to attention, sneaking a final chew on their gum as they did so. Their faces were smeared with cocoa and linseed oil. It gave a Halloween twist to their grins. When the general ordered them to stand easy, he would move among them. "Where are you from?" General Ike would ask one boy. "What did you do in civilian life? How old are you? Are you a good shot with that rifle? What do you weigh? Who's the toughest man in the battalion?" And so it went down the line. And invariably, off in another corner of the field, the men would start shouting for Ike. Yes, just Ike. And over he'd go, repeating the questions all over again, verbally sparring with them, giving them the impression that this general was just one of the guys who thought they were the best soldiers in the world. One boy said he was an expert rifleman. Good, said the general. That's what we'll win for you tonight. From one quick-witted youngster, the general was told that the toughest man in the battalion would be selected after they jumped in France. Good, said the general. Send him back to me and I'll have something for him. But the visit was brief. The yell went down the line to load plane one, and the men started trooping off. General Ike yelled good luck and saluted them time after time. This outfit had been assigned the toughest mission of all. They knew it, and the general knew it. And both are part of a winning team. Soon, hundreds of planes were circling overhead in the gathering gloom, their warm yellow lights making them look like huge horizontal Christmas trees rushing into the night. They took formation and disappeared toward the channel, extinguishing their lights to make their approach as the first wave to strike on the second front. His face raised to their thundering black shapes, General Eisenhower watched the planes disappear toward France. Nothing to do now but sweat it out back at the camp. Try to read a cheap murder mystery or a Wild Westerner. Refrain from calling any of the commanders for news. Just hang on and wait. A stroll down the path with slippers and robe and another cigarette. A pause to hear the faint passage of a fleet of bombers. A game of checkers or gin rummy with Commander Butcher. Will the night never end? Phlegmatic. But when his men have left him behind, he's with them always, just the same. The battle has been joined until his men appeal to him for his renewed assistance. As the campaign takes more definite shape from its fluid beachhead, the general will take his chance and wait.
That was how it started. Then our troops launched the great assault. That assault, too, was officially announced in an historic broadcast at 3:32 o'clock this morning, Eastern Wartime. Communique number one from the Supreme Allied Headquarters. Here is the recording of that dramatic message.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
NBC has just brought you on transcription two historic broadcasts, reports by which the nation first heard of the Allied invasion of the continent in the early hours of this morning.
This is the NBC Newsroom in New York. We now continue with a program of music.
And now we bring you Tommy Taylor and tailor-made songs with Irving Miller and his orchestra. This program of music will be interrupted immediately on receiving news of the invasion front.
This lovely day will lengthen into evening. We'll sigh goodbye to all we've ever had. Alone, where we have walked together, I'll remember April and be glad. I'll be content. You love me once in April. Your lips were warm, and love and spring were new. But I'm not afraid of autumn and her sorrow, for I'll remember April and you. the fire will dwindle into glowing ashes. For flames and love live such a little while. I won't forget, but I won't be lonely. I'll remember April and I'll smile. I'll be content. You love me once in April. Your lips were warm and love and spring were new. But I'm not afraid of autumn and her sorrow, for I'll remember April and you. The fire will dwindle into glowing ashes. For flames and love live such a little while. I won't forget, but I won't be lonely. I'll remember April and I'll smile. Saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. You knew just what I was there for. You heard me sing a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, "Please adore me." And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Now I'm no longer alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
Thank you.
You have been listening to songs by Tommy Taylor, music by Irving Miller and his orchestra, coming to you from New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.